Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, 13th time lucky. The Bank of England turns the screw a little more on borrowers, raising rates to 5% after inflation figures came out worse than expected. But is it all too late? And is there another way? We thought we'd dodged it, but is recession inevitable now? What will it mean for our money? Average rates on two-year fixed-term deals surpass 6% this week. Is the mortgage crisis really as bad as the 70s and 80s? And should the government intervene to help out? We look at what you can do if you're struggling to make your repayments. And if you're looking for an extra bob or two, Lee's here to tell us how to turn a side hustle into a full-time gig. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the 13th time on the bounce this week over concerns that inflation pressures were becoming more persistent. At 5%, the base rate now sits at the highest level in 15 years. The day before the announcement, we got worse than expected inflation figures. While the headline rate was the same as the previous month, worryingly, core inflation increased. Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Lee. Simon, firstly, if you would, unpack the inflation news and then explain why it meant the Bank of England felt they had to act, and act more than people were expecting. Well, earlier in the week, certainly. Why did inflation stick at 8.7%? What is core inflation? Why did that increase? What does it all mean, Simon?
So, Georgie, the inflation figures were unfortunately exactly the inflation figures that we didn't need. What people were looking for was for the headline rate of CPI inflation, the consumer prices index measure of inflation, to come down again. Instead, it stuck at 8.7% in May, which was unchanged from April. That would be bad enough news in itself. However, unfortunately, the underlying measure that triggered this freak out in the mortgage market and in the money markets last month, core inflation, which is the important measure that the Bank of England looks at underlying the inflation figures, unfortunately, that continued to rise. And that is a problem. Core inflation strips out a couple of things that are volatile, like food and energy, to try to give a truer picture of inflation, and some other things that are massively influenced by tax, for example, alcohol. Now, the problem with core inflation rising is that this is seen as something that the Bank of England is watching very, very closely, because it's what drives up the inflation rate and drives it down, with the other stuff sprinkled on the top. And the core inflation figure came in much higher than thought a month earlier. In fact, it's still been rising. And even though headline inflation is coming down, core inflation is on the up. Core inflation continued to be on the up. Whether the Bank of England changed its mind on interest rates off the back of this week's inflation reading is a matter of some debate, however. Whether it changed its mind based off last month's inflation reading is again a matter of debate. But if you take the two inflation readings together, the two sets of core inflation data, and then also all of the other things that have come out over the past month, it creates this bundle of inflationary pressures that the Bank of England is still seeing in the economy. And so it felt it needed to act and deliver a bumper rate rise of 0.5%. Now, we're going to go into whether that was the right move and whether continuing to raise rates is the right move and whether it's actually having the desired effect later in the podcast. But that's the thinking behind the Bank of England's move. And also the other thing there is the Bank of England is under a huge degree of criticism for not having spotted inflation earlier and acted earlier. The Bank of England has spent a very long time sitting on its hands, keeping rates super low, keeping monetary policy super loose. Now it's gone in the other direction. And as I said yesterday, after the result, it's nice to know that groupthink works in both directions. When you cannot raise interest rates for a really, really long time, even though they should have gone up, And then you could just keep raising them, even though you can see that it's starting to cause serious problems. So there you go. That's why they raised interest rates. And the other reason is the theory behind it. Raising interest rates makes the cost of lending more expensive. Banks pass that on to their customers. That reduces the demand for lending. So it reduces the amount of money flowing into the economy from new loans being created, not just to mortgage borrowers. They get a lot of the attention, but it's businesses as well. That slows down the economy, dampens demand. And also these rate rises send a very strong signal to people. We're going to crack down. We're possibly even going to crash this into recession. You stop demanding these big pay increases. Stop pumping up your prices for your customers. And we want to try and get a grip on inflation and crush it. And in a year's time, we will have crushed inflation back down to the 2% target because we're the Bank of England and we are great. Versus people thinking, bank's not really doing anything about this. Inflation is probably still going to be 6% in a year's time. And that's what it's trying to act on, not the inflation that we've already seen. That 8.7% in that report this week has already happened. Bank can't do anything about that. What it's trying to do is stop inflation in the future.
Lee, what's the wrong with inflation?
Well, we're seeing it now, aren't we? Everything's gone up in price in the last 12 to 18 months. And having a look through these inflation figures, a lot of it is to do with energy bills, food prices. But we've seen other sort of strange things that have pushed up inflation. So things like secondhand car prices and flights. It feels like everyone's going on holiday this year compared to previous years. It feels like the demand has absolutely rocketed there. All those things are becoming more expensive. Something like a flight, it's because there's more demand. Fuel prices for airplanes have gone up, although that has come down a bit now. Staffing costs, and this is where it comes in about pay rises and you pesky workers, stop asking for pay rises. You know, all of this stuff then gets passed on to customers and you feel it in your pocket. So, you know, we see this in our day-to-day lives. You know, I think all of us can safely say that our energy bills, unless you're someone lucky who's still somehow on some fixed deal, but the majority of us now are on energy bills that are incredibly high. Although this week I had an email through from my supplier with the new rates, which are going to be far lower from July. We've seen it in our supermarket bills. I mean, some of the things now, incredible prices. When you look at things like jars of coffee, washing powder, that kind of stuff, I've really noticed it. You know, and I don't tend to notice this stuff as much. You know, pretty lackluster supermarket shopper. But when I'm starting to notice prices and you think, no, actually, I'm not going to buy that. All of this stuff is just getting more and more expensive because of things like energy, where it's pumped up production costs. Fuels was more expensive, but it's come down massively compared to where it was last year. I mean, petrol prices are down sort of 40-45p a litre compared to this time last year. So it's not all bad news. You know, there are little trinkets of light. There's little bits and pieces. And I think that's why this inflation figure this week was a little bit of a surprise. And of course, what's wrong with high inflation is now we're seeing the bank firefighting with higher interest rates, and that makes the cost of borrowing more expensive. And thus, lots of people, especially Simon says, a lot of mortgage borrowers get the headlines, get the attention. But a lot of people, millions, in fact, will be rolling off two-year fixed deals and rolling off two-year fixed deals with monthly bills probably going to be going up quite sizable amounts. So all of those things, it's like a perfect storm for people's finances. But I feel like it's been one thing after the other. You know, we've had the pandemic, and then we had this cost of living crisis, and that was a kind of inflation base rate crisis. But you know, the Bank of England base rate's gone up to 5% this week. But some would say that is just a normal rate. That is what we've just been on a diet of rock bottom interest rates for the last decade, more than a decade. And it's at some point, I guess, the party had to stop and people had to be weaned off rock bottom interest rates at some point. So here we go. And now here we are. But I guess the thing is, no one forecast this such a sharp rise. I think that's what's kind of knocked people for six, the way this has happened since December 2021. To now, that the real sharp rises are just kind of, they've come as a bit of a shock. And I guess you asked a couple of weeks ago about making predictions and I'm not making predictions. And I think the last couple of weeks probably shows you why, because even since Monday, I feel like things have changed. And all of a sudden we're talking about higher interest rates again, talking about at least 6% potentially before the end of the year. I think a month ago, we were talking about, or 6 weeks to a month ago, talking about this being the end of the cycle at 5%. So, who knows?
Simon, Lee mentioned there about the other things that have been going up in price that, you know, perhaps we haven't been so focused on? Have we been sort of been blindsided by, you know, the energy crisis, that we've missed other signals and indicators in the market? I mean, actually, people like yourself have been mentioning it for some time, but has that sort of blinded us to some of the real issues? But could we have done anything if we had spotted them?
Are you asking me to talk about hot tubs here, Georgie? The leading inflation
indicator.
Money leading inflation indicator. The thing that rang the alarm bells all the way back in the summer of 2020.
I remember.
That the economy was doing much better than expected, and that maybe, just maybe, we didn't need interest rates still to be at 0.1%, which was the level that they were cut to as the world shut down en masse at the end of March. We have argued for a long time, long before the Bank of England even had inflation as a twinkle in its little eye, and long before it was even maintaining that it was transitory, it wasn't even acknowledging it at that point. We have long maintained that a lot of this COVID stuff was going to be quite inflationary. We've carried lots of articles on it, as have many of our peers. So how the Bank of England seems to think that it's able to have this excuse that nobody saw this coming, I don't know. But so you go back to hot tubs, holiday rentals, things like that, garden furniture, big, big ticket items, right? Big ticket items. Late 2020, early 2021, wasn't just a supply issue, was a demand issue, couldn't get your hands on them. And so we've got interest rates crashed all the way down to 0.1% at the same time as the government is handing out money directly to people in the form of furlough and other support schemes, and even at one point paying them to go out for lunch and dinner. Not going to be inflationary, don't worry about it. Then that shifted to transitory. Don't worry, it's going away. Lots of people going, I don't think it does look so transitory. At this point, it was quite deafening from the critics of central banks saying, not transitory, not transitory, not transitory, going to end badly. And still central banks sat on their hands. Now, to be fair to the Bank of England, okay, it did actually raise interest rates first. It did it before the Fed, but it still did it way too late. We were on 0.1% for way too long. So then you fast forward to the bit that you just asked about, the energy crisis. And yes, I think you're right, actually. I think that the energy crisis very much masked what was going on with inflation. It created a convenient bogeyman to pin this stuff on. And I am not saying that Russia's invasion of Ukraine did not cause major problems and have a major inflationary impact, certainly in energy prices, but also feeding through to things like food prices and grain and stuff like that. But inflation was already at 6% at that point, and interest rates were way too low. I think they were at 0.5% at that point. I think we'd only just moved up. And the time to be making big interest rate moves is not now, not when you're crushing an entire generation of homeowners. The time to be making big interest rate moves was at the start. They could have gone from 0.1 to 1%. Real signal, right, that's it. Inflation, maybe not going to be as transitory as we think, but you tell you what, we're going to make it transitory. But no, we inched up at the start and then it's turned into mayhem at the end. So yes, I do think that energy prices mask this. And I think it's only relatively recently that everybody started going, food prices, whoa, food prices. Mm-hmm. You know, Bank of England's worried about food prices. Bank of England's worried about wages. It's not a good look, is it? If I was Andrew Bailey on 575 grand a year, I'd be a little bit more careful about how I talk about how people can't keep having these wage increases.
Yeah.
Particularly as most switched on people realise they're not getting a wage increase. They're actually getting a real decrease because they're getting increases below inflation. Number might look big, but somebody let inflation get much bigger than the pay rise number. I'd also probably be a bit careful if I was Jeremy Hunt with some of the rhetoric about crushing inflation, because Jeremy Hunt, last time I looked, was a highly successful multimillionaire businessman, which is something to be proud of. But I don't think Jeremy Hunt really understands what's going on for the over-mortgaged generation in their 30s and 40s, who basically have had house prices pumped up underneath them. And they had literally no choice if they wanted to get on the housing market than to buy these ridiculously expensive houses, take on these huge mortgages. And now 13 rate rises in a row in a really short period of time is absolutely crushing them. And if they haven't had the fixed rate end yet, it will end soon. And they're going to get absolutely hammered. So what else do you do is the question. Well, it is unfortunate because, as you just said, they didn't really pay enough attention to it and they painted themselves into a corner. But I do find myself in the very odd position as somebody who's spent the last 15 years arguing that interest rates needed to be higher than they were and needed to get back to normal, to then find myself in the position of criticising the Bank of England, which has now finally managed to get interest rates back to something approaching normal. However, it did spend an awful lot of time promising people that rises would be gradual and limited. It's the speed of this. And I don't even think they've allowed long enough for it to take effect.
Indeed. Look, we'll get on to mortgages in a minute. But of course, Lee, I mean, that's if those who have a mortgage. What about the poor people who are trying to buy a house for the first time, perhaps? But as I said, we'll go into that in a second. What are the expectations, Lee, as to how high rates will go? And also, is there any evidence that in the last sort of year and a half of rising rates, it's actually doing anything?
Well, I think the fact that, as Simon was mentioning, you know, inflation is stuck at where it was the month previous, and it feels like trying to sort of sort the problem after the horse has bolted type thing. So, I mean, at the moment, I don't think it's really filtering through in terms of what it's doing to interest to inflation rates. And the expectation is, well, look, yesterday the MPC voted 7-2, so 7 of the members voted for 5%. And 2 of them voted to stick it at 4.5%. So there are murmurings of, you know, people on the committee that are not so hawkish, you know, they're more dovish. They want to kind of rein it in a little bit. But the expectation now in the short term is that if really interest base rate looks like it's going to go up to 6%. You know, the next decision, will it go up another 0.5%? I mean, that's the big question now. I think 0.5% didn't feel that realistic this time around a couple of weeks ago. And then all of a sudden, as I say, things changed pretty quickly. And then it all priced in that it was going to be 0.5%. And I think the real bellwether of that was earlier in the week and the end of last week, we saw savings rates getting pumped up left, right and centre. I mean, some real big, sizable savings rate increases, which made me think, they know something here almost, you know, and lots of changes coming in into the repricing of the mortgage market. So they, I felt like it was kind of on the cards. We're probably going to see 6% this year, but I don't make predictions, as you know. You know, lots of things could change very quickly. Maybe the next inflation figure will be far lower than what was anticipated. And all of a sudden, it's a different conversation. You know, that's the thing at the moment. It's a bit of the unknown. Things are happening quite short, fast bursts. We could be facing, people could be facing 7% mortgage rates. And that's quite like scary to people.
I'm keen to talk mortgages in a while, and I will. But I also think that everybody's so obsessed with people with mortgages that actually it looks like we're hurtling headlong into recession, which... it's probably not good for many people. So, I mean, is it only those with mortgages that are affected by this, what's going on in the economy at the moment? I mean, is everybody else going, yeah, go Bank of England, get those rates up, baby, because we need inflation down. And I wish he might be, because he made some silly pledge about halving it.
Well, you're totally right. That's the thing. There's a large proportion of homeowners in this country that own their home outright. They don't have a mortgage. There's a large proportion of people in this country that are renters. They don't have a mortgage. So I'm not they're not sitting there rubbing their hands with glee going, oh, yeah, wow. I think the people that have been waiting for higher savings rates have definitely been rubbing their hands in glee because they haven't been able to get a return. But the big problem with that is they're getting now nice returns, but it's still not beating inflation. So they're losing the money in real terms. And that's the thing. It's like, it almost feels like no one's kind of winning at the moment. Like it almost feels like we're in a strange little period of time where it's really hard to sort of eke out the wins. And, you know, people as a whole, as we've been talking about here, we've all faced higher prices in all different ways, shapes and forms. And I think that's what the argument is when we're talking about mortgages, and the whole rhetoric shouldn't just be about mortgage holders, but when people took out mortgages, you know, typically on a 2-year fix, you know, should it have been a 2-year fix in the first place? Should it have been a longer term fix, especially with rates long, like, you know, as low as they were, and people were stress tested at certain levels, but those stress tests didn't factor in things like far higher energy bills, far higher food costs, all of that kind of thing. So as a whole, I think that most people are feeling it in their pockets. And that's why lots of people are chasing down higher wages. That's why, you know, we're seeing strikes left, right and center, because people feel like they can't keep up with bills. So naturally what they want is to be paid more. And it's just a vicious cycle. It's a vicious spiral, I would say.
Thank you very much, Lee. Simon, before we move on from the Bank of England, it's just, you mentioned there earlier, groupthink. Are there lessons that we can learn from how our central bank has responded to this, the way that it's made up, the powers it has? Is it not independent enough? What can we learn from this?
Well, firstly, I think it's very independent. I think that one of the very good things that has been done over the past couple of decades has been the independence of the Bank of England from the government. And the reason behind that is because you don't want the government setting interest rates, because then the government can set interest rates to suit itself and the election cycle and all those other things. You can see how that leads down a dangerous path. So the Bank of England is very independent, but I do think that there is an issue with groupthink. I think that the Monetary Policy Committee is full of very, very smart people. They all tend to be very, very smart people from a similar background. You know, they're all kind of academic, worked in business and finance. I mean, I'm guessing they're all probably quite rich. I don't know how many of them have mortgages. I think there is a question as to whether you need, maybe not on the Monetary Policy Committee, but maybe feeding directly into that in a way that people can actually see some representatives of the real economy, the people who are out there at the coalface every day dealing with stuff. Now, I know that the Bank of England collects huge amount of data and figures and reports, and it's got people out there scouring the economy to work out what's going on, but it definitely seems to have taken its eye off the ball this time round. And I think that if you had a panel of people that, you know, included a builder and some other people like that, they might have possibly spotted inflation a little bit earlier and said, hey, look, this is actually quite bad at the moment. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you reform it. I definitely think that there is an argument for reform, and there's talk about this. But the problem is, like, there's always talk. It's like these inquiries that we're always holding, these endless inquiries into things. You question whether anything ever gets done out the back of them. So I don't know. I'd like to see us try to learn some lessons from this. I think one of the, obviously, mortgages steals the headlines here. But to go back to your point earlier, one of the places that this obviously hits is businesses. Business borrowing costs have gone up substantially. And that is definitely going to have an impact on many businesses. Government borrowing costs have gone up substantially as well. We've seen gilts hit levels that they haven't hit for a very long time. This is all going to feed through into the economy. But it's quite a strong possibility that we still manage to dodge recession, because actually the pain is targeted quite narrowly rather than being broadly spread across. But even if we dodge a technical recession, I don't think we're going to dodge something that feels like a recession.
With all that in mind, Simon, problems with businesses and government, etc., what's the impact on investors at the moment? We're talking about savers, homeowners. What about investors?
Well, to a certain degree, investors are somewhat insulated from this if they are, I hesitate to use the phrase doing things right, but if they're doing things right. So as an investor, what you want to do is you want to spread your risk and diversify. If you're only invested in the UK, you're not really doing it right. You might be a hardened stock picker who's just got a portfolio of shares in their UK companies. But even if those companies are only exposed to the UK, you're not doing it right. What you want, ideally, is a selection of companies. You know, if you're holding individual shares, at least 15 to 20 individual shares, companies that do different things get affected by different stuff. Because that means that when the market gets a hammering, hopefully you've spread your risk slightly. If you're not doing that, you're taking a huge amount of risk. If you're only invested in the UK, you're taking a lot of risk. If your only holding is a FTSE 100 tracker, you're taking quite a lot of risk, but probably not as much as you think, because an awful lot of the earnings of those FTSE 100 companies are actually derived from overseas. So as an investor, it's not just what's going on in the UK that you need to think about, it's what's going on in the world. And the good news is that not everywhere has the exact same stubborn inflation problem that we have. For example, in the United States, inflation has come all the way down to 4%. And the United States stock market makes up about 50 to 60% of the global stock market. So over in the States, things are looking up. In fact, some of these tech firms that had taken a hammering last year have been going great guns. And the S&P 500 this year is up substantially. It's doing very well. The FTSE 100, on the other hand, isn't doing as well, which is a reversal of fortune from last year when this S&P 500 fell by quite a bit and the FTSE 100 managed to keep its head above water. So as an investor, you need to look at the broader picture and go, okay, this might affect the UK, but does that mean that I should be shunning the UK, as in going more global with my portfolio, more towards other countries? Or does it mean that the UK stock market is underpriced and cheap, and therefore offers an opportunity because share prices tend to move ahead of economic data? So, you know, the stock market and the economy don't move in tandem. And often the markets will have managed to work out amongst all of those participants what's going on before the government and the people have. And so you could find that actually, you know, the market is underpriced, but you need to look at it, you need to make those decisions, and you need to decide whether you're actually going to try to target individual areas or whether you're just going to spread your money around the world in a cheap global tracker fund and then forget about it.
All right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, just had your feet up this week, haven't you? Just been another quiet one.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned last week how you would know a little bit more about the UK state of play by this Friday, and I wasn't very optimistic about it. And unfortunately, that was kind of proved right, wasn't it? Inflation came in higher than expected. The Bank of England raised by 0.5. We originally thought it might be 0.25, and now traders bet that the Bank of England will raise until we reach 6.25%, which would be the highest since 1998. Tough to see any silver linings out there right now, other than if everyone is bearish, maybe it takes a little bit of less bad news to improve sentiment. So one to watch. Elsewhere, stocks have retreated this week mostly, but after a strong run, I don't think there is reason for panic. You could argue that the broader market is worried a touch more about recession risks this week, but the VIX is now below 13, lowest since, you know, early 2020, which indicates that maybe there isn't too much panic just yet.
And what do we have to look forward to next week?
Hopefully a pretty quiet one, especially when we compare that to the previous fortnight. UK watchers will be keeping an eye out for any comments about rates and inflation and mortgage rates and so on. But really, from a scheduled point of view, there isn't anything that leaps out at me. I mean, US-wise, we've got a final GDP reading, but because it's a final reading, unlikely to do too much. We've got another inflationary metric on the Friday, the latest PCE number. So maybe probably top of the list there, but I won't be expecting fireworks, as sort of mentioned at the beginning. For individual stock watchers, Nike report their earnings, as well as Micron Technology and UK-based Carnival. So worth keeping a watch on that. I'd suppose other than that PCE number, the main thing to note is that next Friday is the last trading day of the month, the quarter, and the first half of the year. So in the build-up to that, market conditions may be a little bit choppy as the big players rebalance and reposition ahead of the second half of the year.
Well, let's hope the week ends well and that mortgage rates start falling as well.
Yes, fingers crossed.
Thanks very much, Sam. Speak to you next week.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. I promised I'd talk about mortgages as the average two-year fix surpassed 6% this week. Banks and building societies are to meet with the Chancellor to discuss what on earth is going on in the mortgage market. Now, there's pressure for lenders and the government to do more to help those struggling with the rapid increase in their repayments. But what should be done? Is it time to wean ourselves off 2-year fixes. But firstly, boy, 6%. Goodness me, that's the average. How much higher will they go?
Yeah, we should point out here, this is the average. And I know we do say this most of the times when we talk about mortgages, but we've got to remember that people have different LTVs, they have different term lengths, they have different, all sorts of different variables in this. It's just more of a kind of benchmark that we can kind of look at this and go, hey, this is where rates are going. So at the moment, they have been rising rapidly, these fixed rates and the averages of them. And they're probably likely to keep going higher still. And there's millions of people that are set to remortgage within the next 12 months or so. This doesn't now look like it's going away whatsoever. So the big question is, how long will mortgages be at this level for? Could it be the next year? Could it be the next 5 years? I mean, don't have a crystal ball, very hard to know. But it's quite clear that we have come off of a decade of ultra low mortgages. I mean, it doesn't even feel like that long ago where we were talking about mortgage rates that were available for under 1%. Now, that feels a bit crazy today. That was not long ago at all. We're literally talking 18 months ago, mortgage rates were that long. And some people would have fixed for 5 years, maybe even longer. I've been seeing in the comment section in some of the stories, people saying about they took out 10-year fixes at rock bottom levels, like 2%, because they felt like they were never, ever going to see mortgage rates this low again. And they wanted to clear off their mortgage debt as fast as they can. And I'm sure they're sitting around smugly now going, I knew this was going to happen. But for other people, it's a massive worry. And we've just come off of a couple of years of very fast house price growth. And some people potentially might have overstretched themselves to go up the ladder, potentially to get a bigger place, more space, that kind of thing, because the decision that they would have made based on the rates that they could get then, not looking down the road and thinking, I wonder what mortgage rates are going to be two years time, 5 years time, because that's just not how we think. It's already galling enough when we buy a property. It's difficult, you know, getting all the wheels in motion. It's not an easy process. So there's a lot of people out there that are rightly worried. And as I said to you a couple of weeks ago, I knew that something was sort of bubbling away in the background, because all of a sudden, like Mortgage Mayhem Part 1, we're now in Mortgage Mayhem Part 2, because the sheer number of friends and friends of friends that messaged me about what they can do about their mortgage rate has just gone through the roof. I don't have the answers. I'm not a broker. I can't sort it out for you. But, you know, there is help out there. And one thing I definitely would not recommend is putting your head in the sand and going, all these mortgage rates are going up, I'm just going to leave it for now. And, you know, if you are someone that is due to remortgage in the near future, the earlier you speak to the lender, the earlier you speak to your broker, I would suggest probably the better, to try and establish a strategy and a plan of what you're going to do.
Simon, I think I noticed on your newsletter, is that right? You were wondering to yourself about 2-year fixes and if it's time to wean ourselves off them. Every time I think of mortgages, I think about Lee saying that blink and you'll miss the 2 years. And I think it seems such an extraordinary short amount of time to fix something that's just so massive and so important.
Yes. So cast your mind back to 2 years ago. When was 2 years ago? 2 years ago was the summer of 2021. It was the second summer of COVID. It wasn't even the first summer of COVID. Does that feel like 2 years ago now? I don't think so. Time passes very, very quickly. And I have lost count of the amount of people that I've had conversations with over the years who took a 2-year fixed rate mortgage, and they said, I literally turned around and I had to remortgage again. Like, I can't believe I got remortgaged again so soon. And I think the only real good reason for taking a 2-year fixed rate mortgage is that you're either at a moment like now, and you have to remortgage, and it's panic stations. Rates are in the middle of a big spike, and potentially, if you lock in for longer at the moment, you're just going to lock in at spike levels, okay? Because I do think we're very much near peak panic. Or you genuinely think that you're going to move home in the next 2 years, okay? And or around about that period. But lots of people do the second one. They say, oh, well, probably move. And then they won't move. I mean, if you're buying a home, for example, and taking out a 2-year fixed rate mortgage, it's very unlikely you're actually going to move in 2 years' time. Most people stay in their properties much longer than that. And if you're buying a home that isn't going to be suitable for you in 2 years' time, you're taking quite a big financial risk. And I would probably say maybe you shouldn't be buying. I would have always said you should buy somewhere that you'd be happy in for the next 5 years. I have a friend who took a 2 year fix 2 years ago because he said, well, the thing is, I don't want to take another 5 year because I might sell my flat. Hasn't sold his flat. 2 year fix is up for renewal. And 2 year fixes are not responsible for the mayhem that we are seeing in the mortgage market at the moment. We've got the Bank of England, government economic blundering, years of low rates and economic mismanagement, central bank mismanagement to thank for that one. But they are definitely compounding the misery. So lots of people who bought maybe in the boom, the government-sponsored buying boom, government and Bank of England-sponsored buying boom 2 years ago, are now come off their two-year fixed rates and they're facing payments going up by a lot. Or people who remortgaged 2 years ago. But many of them are probably thinking, oh, I wish I'd remortgaged for 5. And if you cast your mind back to the financial crisis, in the US, one of the problems that was flagged was this thing called teaser rates. Teaser rates, they were awful because you basically agreed to have a lower rate and lower payments as an introductory offer. And then all of a sudden your rate shot up. I remember thinking back then as a young This Is Money mortgage reporter that these sounded suspiciously like two-year fixed rate mortgages. And if you were to go to the US or France, for example, or many other countries, even a five-year fix would be considered short term. Now, I think the problem is that every time we try to push longer term mortgages, the mortgage industry goes, oh, people just aren't really interested. But lots of people want two-year fixes, or more people take five-year fixes now. But you know, they just don't want to fix for a long term. But I don't think that that's because people wouldn't actually like this. I think it's because it's not being offered to them in a way that they want to take it on. They worry about, well, what if I move home? What if I lock in at a longer rate? All this kind of stuff. You could construct these mortgages in a way that works for people and a way that works for the housing market, and it makes things better. Because I think two-year fixed rate mortgages should come with a substantial financial health warning, right? If you're happy to take a gamble, then that's fine. But I don't think that all of those people taking two-year fixes have it spelt out to them fully how much of a gamble it is. And I actually think that if a lot of people involved in this, the government, the banks, the building societies, even the mortgage brokers who've criticized me on Twitter for this, because they love a two-year fix, mortgage brokers do, right? And they say, well, people love them. Well, yeah, but that doesn't mean that people are right. Basically, sometimes people need protecting from themselves. That's why we stick health warnings on stuff. Okay, I think that they know deep down that these are a fundamentally risky product in the way that a longer term fix is not. So I think that they are definitely contributing to this. And I'll tell you a little me related mortgage story, if you don't mind. Okay, so people worry about this kind of like higher rates and locking in at higher rates. When I took out my first mortgage, when me and my wife took out our first mortgage, we fixed for 5 years in 2006 at 4.99%. And I thought at that time, and I was correct, that this was historically cheap money. The opportunity to fix your mortgage at under 5% was a great deal and one worth taking. And that was true at the time. And actually, it managed to remain true for quite a lot of that five-year fixed rate mortgage period. We bought our first flat. The flat cost £228,000 for a one-bedroom flat, a garden flat in London. At the time, it felt like we were spending an unbelievable amount of money. I remember saying to a friend, I can't believe that I'm spending nearly £250,000 on a one-bedroom flat. Now, what happened after that was prices went up for a bit. They were already going up at that point, and then they crashed during the financial crisis, credit crunch crash. Base rate got dragged all the way down, but mortgage rates didn't come down that much due to the credit crunch element. It was only towards the end of that five-year fixed rate period that mortgage rates started to be substantially cheaper. But even when they did start to become substantially cheaper, I didn't sit there kicking myself that I'd missed out on the opportunity to grab this two-year fix at a lower rate. What I actually thought was, do you know what? I've managed to know exactly what my mortgage payments were for 5 years. That's really done me a favor. It protected me when times were bad. And now I'm maybe paying a little bit more when times are good. But do you know what? It was worth it for the protection when times are bad. And those higher rates would have kept a lid on house prices. But instead, what happened is rates got slashed down very, very low. Mortgage rates came down very, very low. The Bank of England came up with funding for lending, which kicked a load of money through to the mortgage market. The government came up with crazy schemes like giving people 25% interest-free loans to buy overpriced new build homes rather than trying to bring down the price of those new build homes. They helped inflate that. And basically, over that period of time since, we have massively inflated the housing market to the point where somebody now faced with a five-year fixed rate mortgage at 4.99%, which is a perfectly reasonable rate to be paying for a mortgage and helps to keep the lid on house prices, is now absolutely terrified because everybody has borrowed so much money that a 4.99% is now an absolute shocker for a generation of homeowners. And if I had to pay 4.99% now on my mortgage, I'd be in financial trouble as well. So that's just a little snapshot of what's happened here. And if we could just get ourselves back to the point where people were fixing mortgages regularly for 5 years and paying roughly 5% interest and pull that level of house prices related to income down, we'd be in a much better financial footing than we are right now.
Simon, finally on this, is this as bad as the 70s and the 80s?
So there's many people will hear, many of the generation who now often own their homes outright, in their kind of 60s, 70s, telling them about how they don't know how lucky they are because they had to deal with interest rates going up to 13% in the late 80s, early 90s. And to an extent, they're right, because actually the late 80s, early 90s crash was devastating for a lot of people. There was lots of people who felt the effect of rates going up immediately because variable rate mortgages were the norm back then. There were people widespread interest-only mortgage borrowing. They had endowments that they were paying into to then pay off those mortgages. But the impact on an interest-only mortgage versus a repayment mortgage is much harder of interest rates going up. There was also the scenario where houses were expensive compared to people's wages. So lots of people had overborrowed. And there wasn't the same degree of forbearance, where there was the similar pressure that's been on banks and building societies ever since the financial crisis up until right now to not repossess people. So there were lots of repossessions. Lots of people then ended up still owing mortgages in negative equity on homes that they didn't have anymore. And there were people who never bounced back from that. It was very, very devastating. However, it's important to note that 13% of a smaller number is equivalent to 6% of a larger number. And there has been lots of data put out there about this kind of stuff. Some of the best I've seen came from our own Jeff Prestridge this week, who spoke to Nationwide. They ran the numbers, allowed for the amount of people's income going on their mortgages. And they said it's not quite as bad as the 70s or 80s yet, but it's nearly there. And also a chap called Neil Hudson, who tweets us at Resi Analyst, who has been doing loads of work on this, really, really good work, and has a chart that shows that 16% is the new 13%. If you adjust for the size of people's mortgages nowadays, and also how much higher they are than their incomes than they used to be, then you will find that the level of interest rates that we are hitting now on mortgages is broadly similar to how it hit people in the late 80s, early 90s. It is also, though, hitting a smaller number of people because the number of mortgaged homeowners in this country has dwindled and is about 30%. Although another data-driven friend of This Is Money, Duncan Lamont of Schroders, suggested it may be as low as 25% now. So you can see how there's lots of people being hit by these rate rises, but they are only a small chunk of the population, and the ones being hit the hardest tend to be those in their 30s and 40s, and also in certain parts of the country, the most overheated, expensive, house price driven parts of the country, unfortunately.
Right, and finally, if you want to make an extra bob or two, or you're fed up with your current job, you have a story on your website that caught my eye: how to turn a side hustle into a full-time gig. Lee, what is this all about? What do you need to think about first? And give us some other ways to make money without quitting your day job.
Nice story, all about side hustles. I actually really, really hate the term side hustles, but I can't think of a better way. I mean, side business, hobby horse business, I don't know, something like that, maybe. But we've launched our new Entrepreneur Academy on This Is Money last week. And in it, you will find lots of inspirational stories of entrepreneurs who have, you know, built up from the ground up, typically. Now, one of these is someone called Katie Anderson. who's featured on the website this week. And she actually quit her marketing job as a marketing director to run a side hustle business full time. And her side hustle business is buying and selling what you'd say secondhand clothes, but what they call in the market, vintage clothes, you know, just to spice it up a bit. But it's become a massive boom industry. And what basically a lot of people do is they go and raid car boot sales, charity shops, that kind of thing, looking for designer items to then flip on for a profit. And they turn this whole thing into a business. And that's exactly what Katie's done. And she's done it enough, you know, to be able to quit her job. And her website is called Pine and Treasure, and she sells the majority of her clothes on Instagram and social media, and that's where it's all going at the moment. That's what a lot of people are getting influenced by, what they see on these social media websites. And so if you're someone that's interested in doing this, let's take clothes as a prime example of this, just because so many people are doing this. And it's not just females, there's males that do this as well, and it can vary from designer dresses. So I always get plugged on my Instagram for retro football shirts. That's something I always get, that people have turned that into a business. You know, they go and raid these places for these retro football shirts, clean them all up, package them up, and sell them for a profit. And it's just old school resale tactics. That's what a lot of these side hustles are. There's a few things that you should consider, though. So as well as marketing it properly, getting it out there properly on social media and all that kind of stuff, you need to be aware of the tax implications, for example, because HMRC has come down like a ton of bricks on these secondhand sellers in the last year. So you need to arm yourself with all of the knowledge of that and make sure you don't come up with a nasty tax thing at the end. And I would treat it in the beginning, if you're someone that's interested in this kind of thing, as more of a hobby, and focusing on something that you love rather than trying to make a fortune doing something that you don't. At least then, if it doesn't go right, you're stuck with, you know, a load of items that essentially you like, and it's something that you've got an interest in. So I'll give you an example of this, and I'm sure I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but I've been collecting a lot of Nintendo items. So wherever I go in the world, I have a little poke around the charity shops or whatever the equivalent is to see if there's anything in there. And actually last month, I was in Hamburg and I was in St. Pauli, and there was this sort of really sort of trendy secondhand flea market type thing going on the Sunday afternoon, which was absolutely packed with Metallica fans, football fans. It was a mad day to be there. I had a little hunt around and I found two GameCube games. And because of all of the Nintendo collecting I've been doing in the last couple of years, I knew exactly how much they were worth, pretty much in my mind. It's like an encyclopedia of Nintendo goods. And these two games were worth about £35 each. So I asked the guy, the German guy that was selling them, how much? And he said, €9 each, or doing both for 15. And I said, will you take 10? And he said, yeah. They were in fantastic condition. And, you know, if I really wanted to, I could probably sell them on for a good profit, but I'm hanging on to all of this stuff. But it's just a very small example of where you can go, and if you become a master or knowledgeable about a certain area or a certain niche of something, you can go out and find bargains to then go and flip around for profits. And this is what a lot of people are doing now. And it quite often starts as a little side hustle thing that you do with your, you know, people don't quit their jobs and just start doing it straight away. But eventually some people do. And it can become a real, real massive business. And people like Katie, people that collect things like video games, because I've got knowledge in that, they go and upload all this stuff on YouTube. They build a following. They become an authority in it. And then all of a sudden, you can turn it into a business where you're making a nice little bit of pocket money on the side. I think the first thing, though, that I would say about this, and I should have taken this to the start, or going to the start at the end, but I think that what holds people back is just getting started doing it. I think a lot of people think about doing this stuff and then they just never get around to doing it. Life gets in the way. So if that's you and you're someone that's interested, I would say, I would write a list and say, what am I most interested in? What's maybe not an oversaturated market? You know, what isn't clothes? What isn't video games? What are people not doing? What do you have like a kind of random interest in? And then just take it from there and start having a roam around and seeing what you can find. That's what I would say. Just go for it.
Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.